Thank you very much for coming to this event. It's great to see such a big turnout. I'm delighted to be able to introduce Professor David Winter, who's our 2009 Brotherton Fellow. Can I just say at the start, it would be great if you could turn your mobiles off, and this is being recorded, as you can see, so be aware of that, please. The Brotherton Lecture takes place every second year and commemorates Dr. Patricia Leslie Brotherton, who was a lecturer in the psychology department and left a bequest to support this visiting fellowship. Professor Winter is a professor of clinical psychology at the University of Hertfordshire, where he directs the doctorate program in clinical psychology. He's also a practicing clinical psychologist who, for a long time, has been head of clinical psychology services at Barnet, Enfield, and Haringey Mental Health Trust. He's a leading expert in the psychology of personal constructs, which is an approach to personality and psychological disturbance which emphasizes the uniqueness of the individual and the richness of mental life and meaning making. He received his PhD from the University of Durham, and since then he's published 5 important books, more than 100 articles and book chapters, and his research and scholarly interests are remarkably broad. So although he's done some work on the evaluation of psychotherapy, and on the assessment of self and psychological conflict, he's applied this approach to a bewildering variety of phenomena, including homicide, addiction, compulsive hair pulling, suicide, sexual dysfunction, post-traumatic reactions, and many things besides that, an incredible breadth. And at the University of Melbourne, he collaborates with Associate Professors Richard Bell and Jennifer Boldero. Professor Winter has served as chair of the psychotherapy section of the British Psychological Society and on the board of directors at the Centre for Personal Construct Psychology. He chairs the research committee of the UK Council for Psychotherapy, and he's on the editorial board of numerous academic journals. He's held visiting and honorary appointments in many countries, including Germany, Greece, Italy, and Spain, as well as a previous one in Australia. We're extremely fortunate to have someone of his caliber and eminence here speaking to us today, especially on such an intriguingly titled talk, Shaking Hands with a Serial Killer. So please make Professor David Winter very welcome.
Thank you very much, Nick, and thank you to the Department of Psychology at the University of Melbourne for giving me my second opportunity to visit one of my favourite cities. I'm very relieved that the weather is no more like it was when I left England. In preparation for this talk, I googled Australian serial killers, and I was surprised to find that one of the first names to appear was Kevin Rudd, who's been given this label for his policy of camel side. In terms of more conventional incidents of serial killing, Australia ranks 3rd in the world, but its 16 cases in Wikipedia's list of notable serial killings seems to pale into insignificance compared to the 145 in the USA, where it's estimated that there are 200 to 300 victims of serial killers every year, and the 43 cases in the UK. There's a book by Paul Kidd, Australia's Serial Killers, subtitled The Definitive History of Serial Multicide in Australia. And this, in fact, lists 30 cases. But it seems to me that not all of them, in fact, fully meet the criteria for the label of serial killer. In the foreword to this book, Professor Paul Wilson states that no one has yet calculated whether, on a population basis, Australia has a higher or lower rate of such offences than anywhere else. It seems strange to me that no one had done this calculation, so I attempted to do it myself. And I did it on the basis of current population figures. So it's probably not entirely accurate, but if you do perform that calculation, the results would seem to indicate that although the prowess of Australia might be declining in some areas, losing the Ashes, for example, It's currently the world leader in serial killing. Serial killing, like other acts of destruction directed either towards others or the self, may seem scarcely comprehensible, but can psychological theory make it more so? Today I want to consider serial killing from the perspective of one such theory, personal construct psychology, developed by Ned's namesake, the American psychologist George Kelly, in 1955. And this theory asserts that each of us actively constructs our world by creating transparent patterns or templates, essentially conceptual goggles, through which we view the world. Kelly's notion of each of us developing our individual construction of events was an early example of the position that has come to be called constructivism. Here's another quote which appears to reflect a constructivist position. All matters turn not on reality, but on perception of reality. A virtue or an evil is only as significant as one believes it to be. Now, the author of this quote is not a famous constructivist psychologist, but an infamous British serial killer, Ian Brady. Some of you may have heard of Ian Brady, but he and his lover, Myra Hindley, achieved notoriety as the Moors murderers in the 1960s by killing at least 5 children and young people. Their usual modus operandi was that Hindley would entice the victim into her car and Ian Brady would eventually kill them, usually after raping them, and they would then bury the body in moorland. In 2001, Brady published a book on his specialist subject, serial killing. And the book is what I've derived that previous quote from. And reading this book, I was struck by the similarity between some of Brady's writing and that of George Kelly, the founder of personal construct psychology. And this led me to write to Ian Brady to inquire whether he'd ever read any of Kelly's work. His reply that he hadn't was in some ways reassuring, but it led to a correspondence between us, which has been continuing ever since. And it also led to a couple of meetings between me and Ian Brady. So in today's talk, I'm going to draw upon Brady's writings, both in his book and in his correspondence with me, together with accounts provided by other serial killers. And I'm going to do so in an attempt to provide a glimpse of the world through the eyes of such an individual. In doing so, I should be adopting what Kelly called a credulous attitude, taking the serial killer's view of the world at face value. Kelly saw the basis of all significant personal relationships as what he termed sociality, essentially trying to make sense of the other person's way of construing. And much of this talk will therefore be an invitation to show sociality towards the serial killer. Applying the credulous attitude with the serial killer is in some ways an exercise in stretching credulity to its limits. However, although in describing the credulous attitude, Kelly said that the client, like the proverbial customer, is always right, he did stress that this didn't necessarily mean that one had to agree with the client in this case, the serial killer, or in any way condone their actions, merely that one had to take their views seriously. Before proceeding further, let's briefly consider previous research on serial killing. That there isn't a great deal of this, to some extent reflects the fact that, thankfully, there isn't a large pool of subjects for the researcher to study. But some researchers have developed classifications of serial killers, such as organized or disorganized killers. Others have made very confident assertions, such as that serial killing can be traced to the killer's experiences in their first few days of life, or that by 2000, serial killing would be preventable by an organized program of testing, diagnosis, and intervention. A claim which the continued proliferation of serial killings clearly shows to be unfounded. This previous research is largely of the type that has been criticized by someone called Nee, in that it rarely takes account of the offender's view of events, but instead it tends to focus on statistical analysis of objective data, such as crime scenes or demographic characteristics of the serial killer or of their victims. Personal construct psychology is not without assessment methods that allow for statistical analysis. One of these is called repertory grid technique, and the repertory grid enables exploration of the individual's view of the world by asking them to rate themselves and other people in terms of constructs or adjectives elicited from the individual concerned. The process of grid completion is usually essentially a face-to-face interview. But a grid may also be constructed from a written narrative, including a book. Although this isn't something to be recommended unless you have a considerable amount of time on your hands. But this was the situation I found myself in on a previous visit to Australia. There isn't a great deal to do in Wollongong. And so I foolishly decided to convert Ian Brader's book into a grid. And the process of doing this involves listing all of the people described in the book and then all of the hundreds of adjectives that are applied to those people. The people then form one axis in the grid, the adjectives the other axis, and the body of the grid consists of a matrix of ticks and blanks in indicating which adjectives are applied to which people. And this slide indicates the descriptions in the book that Ian Brady applied to himself. And you may be able to see that many of these refer to values and beliefs. For example, having relativistic thought processes, believing that a supreme individualist should choose his own life and the moment of his death, and rather being dead than staring into an abyss. Values and beliefs also constituted the largest category of descriptions that Brady applied to serial killers in general. So we have things like regarding the willful destruction of others and the self as comic, believing in a hell on earth, thirsting for a realm of total possibility, etc., etc. There are also descriptions to do with power and control, proving he exists beyond the control of all. There's high egoism, feeling morally superior, for example. there's lack of tenderness. Some of these are categories derived from a classification system for personal constructs. But lack of tenderness includes regarding people as obstacles to be surmounted by any available means. And a rather chilling one, being an architect of ruin. Now, various statistical procedures may be applied to a grid, and this is the result of a procedure called hierarchical cluster analysis, which essentially indicates the similarities and differences in Brader's descriptions of the various people in the book. All of the serial killers cluster together in the bottom half of that figure, and the non-serial killers in the top half. And the relative length of the horizontal lines indicates that Brady has a much more differentiated view of serial killers than of non-killers. But interestingly, he dissociates himself from other serial killers. And this is a tendency which has been demonstrated in other individuals, such as problem drinkers, who have a stereotype of a particular group to which they belong, but dissociate themselves from that stereotype. I won't go into it, but the same pattern is indicated in another method of analysis, multidimensional scaling, where all the non-killers cluster together as an undifferentiated mass at the center of the graph, but the serial killers are viewed in a much more distinctive way. Now, from the perspective of personal construct psychology, all of our behavior is an experiment in that it's an attempt to test out hypotheses about and give meaning to our world. Killing would be seen as no different from any other behavior in that respect. And something of its experimental nature is indicated by Ian Brady. When discussing murder, he says that sometimes it's a most stimulating experience to do something you don't want to do, don't approve of, and are legally proscribed from experiencing, just to discover new aspects of yourself and others. If killing is an experiment, then serial killing might be regarded as a research program. And Brady writes of the progression from the first murder, in which the murderer kills his long-accepted self as well as the victim, to the second murder, in which the killer may, in Brady's view, experiment with elevated aestheticism, and then gradually develops an addiction to hedonistic nihilism. He also indicates that some serial killers vainly try to recapture the experience of the first murder. For example, Alexander Potushkin, he's a Russian who, thankfully for one individual, was captured after falling one short of his ambition of killing one person for each of the 64 squares on a chessboard. He describes the first murder as being unforgettable, like first love. For some serial killers, their experiment involves what Kelly calls slot rattling, where the person shifts from an extreme view of a person or event to the completely opposite view. Personal construct research on people who've committed a single offence of extreme violence, resulting in the deaths of their victims, has indicated that they slot rattled from an extremely positive to an extremely negative view of the victims. And some other studies, including one which I've carried out on police officers who've committed criminal offences themselves, has indicated that slot rattling and violence are more common in people who have a very undifferentiated view of the world. In serial killers, as in sexual offenders, their slot rattling is more commonly from a view of the self as abused and humiliated, to seeing themselves as abusive and powerful. Episodes of humiliation and impotence are commonplace in the histories of serial killers. And one of these, Andrei Shikatilo, describes it as it seeming that impotence has hounded him all his life. It's ruined my whole life. I felt like a eunuch, humiliated, like I wasn't a man at all. Like I was deprived of something basic. All my life I felt humiliated. His slot rattling from this position of humiliation involved killing and cannibalizing at least 50 people. Chikatilo's experiments in murder can be considered to involve what George Kelly called dilation, in that he constantly extended the range of his murderous ambitions and of his victims. And this was also the case with a British serial killer, Peter Sutcliffe, the so-called Yorkshire Ripper, who began by killing prostitutes, but then, as described in this quote by Ian Brady, went on to kill any woman who looked remotely like a prostitute or who happened to be in the vicinity of a red light district. I should say that much of Ian Brady's book consists of interviews with other serial killers whom he's met in a variety of prisons and maximum security hospitals. Dilation is often accompanied by rather grandiose ideas, and this is evident in a notice that hung in the lorry that Peter Sutcliffe used to drive, which says that in this truck is a man whose latent genius, if unleashed, would rock the nation, whose dynamic energy would overpower those around him. Better let him sleep. Incidentally, Sutcliffe provides another interesting example of slot rattling in that he initially regarded himself as on a mission from God, but eventually viewed himself as guided by the devil. Now, the opposite process to dilation is what Kelly called constriction, in which one draws in the boundaries of one's world to eliminate people or events that are unpredictable and thus anxiety-provoking. And this elimination can in some cases be very literal, as is evident by this quote concerning the murder of Jack the Hat. Jack the Hat was a member of a London criminal gang led by the infamous Cray twins. And poor Jack had to go because he'd begun behaving in a very unpredictable way. And this is a description by one of the men who disposed of his body after Reg Cray had killed him. And he says there are so many things he was doing wrong, he was embarrassing them because he wouldn't take no notice of what they said. I mean, they've got to have a bit of respect. Man's got to do as he's told, but he disregarded everything they said. He was undermining them, he was making them a fucking laughingstock, so they had to act, and the only way to hold credibility was to fucking do him. A different example of constriction is provided by an amazing character. Some of you might have heard of him, Jean-Claude Roman. He was known to his family as an eminent medical researcher who for 20 years drove from his home in France to his office at the World Health Organization in Geneva. In fact, he was nothing of the sort, and rather than driving to Geneva, he went to walk in the local forest or to meet his mistress. And the only times he ever went to the WHO office was to pick up pamphlets from its reception area, which he then scattered around his home. Eventually, faced with the unravelling of his web of lies, he killed his wife, his children, and his parents to prevent them from discovering the truth about him. And in this quote, he describes the peace and beauty that have been provided by constricting his identity to that of a murderer and nothing but a murderer. "I've never been so free. Life has never been so beautiful. I'm a murderer. I'm seen as the lowest possible thing in society. But that's easier to bear than the 20 years of lies that came before." Similarly, in Ian Brader's view, serial killing may in some cases be seen as an attempt to escape from chaos, in which the serial killer, conceiving of life as meaningless and death as nothingness, is not afraid to die or kill in an attempt to introduce some degree of design. For Brady, the serial killer, having confronted the chaos or absurdity of existence, is trying to impose upon it some meaning and order of his own, so that destruction can become an act of creation. Incidentally, George Kelly viewed some cases of suicide in a similar light, in that for the individual, life has become so uncertain and chaotic that death provides for them the only certainty. Now, an example of the type of serial killer being described by Brady is Dennis Nilsson, another British serial killer, who picked up young homeless men, took them home with him, killed them, and kept their bodies for company until they had to be disposed of. He then flushed the body parts down the toilet and was eventually captured after he succeeded in blocking the drains in the fashionable part of London where he lived. And this is a quote from Dennis Nilsson where he describes how he washed his victims' bodies, put talc on them, and in effect created something beautiful, like a Michelangelo sculpture, out of a person whose life had previously been ugly and chaotic. So he says, describing one of the bodies, it seemed that for the first time in his life, he was really feeling and looking the best he ever did in his whole life. I just lay there and a great peace came over me. I felt this was it, the meaning of life, death, everything. Nilsson also said that he could no longer kill because there were no longer any mysteries to trouble him. It's perhaps the medical killer who best exemplifies killing as a means of achieving control and order. Indeed, perhaps only Roman emperors who could signal life or death of a gladiator by raising or lowering their thumb has greater power in this area than does a doctor. When Dr. Harold Shipman was convicted of killing 15 of his patients, of whom he's suspected of killing maybe as many as 1,000 more, he achieved the questionable distinction of becoming Britain's most prolific serial killer. However, he's only one of several doctors and nurses who've included murder, or clinicide as it has been termed, in their possible range of interventions. The first quote on this slide is by the coroner, who regarded Shipman as motivated by control and as an arrogant power addict. The second quote is by the son of one of his victims, who says, "Dr. Shipman was a marvellous GP, except for the fact that he killed my father." For the serial killer, killing essentially becomes their way of life, their career. And Ian Brady describes this way of life as choosing not to exist as a grey daub on a grey canvas, but as an existential riot of every colour in the spectrum. Rudolf Pleyel simply says that every man has his passion. Some prefer whist. I prefer killing people. And the second quote is by Paul John Knowles, who, by committing 18 murders, was able to see himself as the only successful member of his family. Third quote there is a bit similar. Matthew James Harris, an Australian serial killer, who thinks of what he's done as an achievement because he's achieved absolutely nothing before in his life. So murdering and getting away with it was an achievement for him. And the final quote is by the wife of Reg Cray, the man who murdered Jack the Hat. And she talks of the brutal way of life, which is all that he'd ever known from his childhood days. For some murderers, killing may be what George Kelly would call a dedicated act, in that it's committed in the service of some ideal. And this was so for Ahmed al-Hasnawi. He was the first pilot who flew into the Twin Towers, and who says that the time of humiliation and subjugation is over. It's time to kill Americans in their heartland. Lord, I regard myself as a martyr for you to accept me as such. As we've seen, Peter Sutcliffe, the Yorkshire Ripper, also regarded himself as under God's protection in his mission to kill all prostitutes. And the final quote here is by another Australian serial killer. He's one of the so-called Snowtown murderers who killed homosexuals, paedophiles, or suspected paedophiles, and even obese people. And he says, "They were the disease and we were the cure." But compare this with the words of Corporal Ryan Dupre, an American Marine in Iraq. "The Iraqis are sick people and we are the chemotherapy." Wait till I get hold of a frigging Iraqi. No, I won't get hold of one. I'll just kill him. And similarly, General James Mattis, also in Iraq. "You got guys who slap women around for 5 years because they didn't wear a veil. Guys like that ain't got no manhood left anyway, so it's a hell of a lot of fun to shoot them." And the final quote there is from the beginning of the Iraq War. You may remember an incident where Saddam Hussein was meant to be eating in a restaurant. Lieutenant Colonel Fred Swan dropped bombs on the restaurant. Turned out that Saddam Hussein wasn't there. Very many people were, and they were also in the apartments next to the restaurant that were destroyed by the bombs. But Lieutenant Colonel Swan's quote indicates the distancing of the military man from his actions by the dehumanization of his victims. He didn't know who was there and didn't really care. you've just got to fall totally into execute mode and kill the target. I think the choice of words there is instructive. He's not killing people, he's killing a target. Now, while Swan may not have been adversely affected by the outcome of his actions, many killers are. And although it's more common to associate post-traumatic stress disorder, PTSD, with the victims of violent offences rather than their perpetrators, there is in fact a fair amount of literature indicating reports of PTSD in murderers and other violent offenders. And I'd briefly like to mention the case of Paul, who was referred to me for treatment of PTSD. As with many of my clients, I started off asking him to write what Kelly would call a self-characterization, which is essentially an autobiographical sketch. And Paul's self-characterization began as follows. Where do we start? How about birth, okay? I was born in Newtown on the 6th of February 1955. I don't remember the birth. Perhaps I was too young, or maybe I had my eyes closed. I don't know. I went to a nursery, then went on to New Road Primary School, before going on to the local secondary school, where my studies were interrupted by an unforeseen event. I killed my father. I don't really know why. My memory of the event doesn't appear full. I was a little screwed up afterwards, and probably still am today. Now, Paul went on to tell me that he'd put what he had done, which he referred to as the big event, up on a shelf and not looked at it. And we considered the positive and negative implications for him of taking the big event down from the shelf by using a personal construct method called ABC technique. And this indicated that he considered that taking the event down from the shelf might, to use a computing metaphor, allow him to develop a programming patch. And it might allow him to be more proactive in contrast to his current directionless life, which he saw as being due to a big block of bad goo sitting in his brain. However, at the bottom of the slide, the disadvantages of taking the event off the shelf were that were included his life possibly reaching a dead end, perhaps literally because he might kill himself. Paul nevertheless decided that he wanted to risk taking the big event down from the shelf and looking at it in an attempt to make sense of why it might have been that as a teenager he went to the garden shed, took an axe and brought it down on his father's head while his father was watching TV. So we explored it over the course of maybe about 3 months, aided by looking at the court file of the case. And gradually he did begin to make some sense of it. And repertory grid assessment indicated that over the course of therapy, the big event became much more integrated in his construct system, his way of viewing the world. And so, essentially, he was able to give it some meaning. At the same time, the symptoms for which he sought therapy gradually diminished, and he made various positive changes in his life, including getting a new job and finding a girlfriend for the first time. And in fact, he's now married the girlfriend. Another of my explorations into the effects of killing on the killer has involved consideration of the experiences of child soldiers. And child soldiers are often forced to engage in multiple killings and other acts of brutality. And there are at least 300,000 children fighting in armed conflicts around the world, boys and girls, and sometimes with their ages not even reaching double figures. And one of the research projects in which I've been involved has been conducted in Sierra Leone, in West Africa, where child soldiers played a very major part in the civil war that ravaged the country for around about 11 years. Typically, they would be abducted by the rebel forces, having often been initiated into atrocities by being forced to commit violence against members of their family or the local community. Daniel, for example, was at gunpoint given an axe and told to chop off the hands of his parents and various of his siblings and cousins, all of whom were then shot, except his two youngest sisters, who were spared so that they could tell other people what they had seen. Amputations by the rebels in Sierra Leone were a popular form of terror, and while they sometimes offered their victims a choice, this was between long sleeves and short sleeves, namely between having your arm amputated at the wrist or at the elbow. Cannibalism was also not uncommon, and future child soldiers were in many cases forced to eat the organs of people whom they'd killed, including members of their families. And it's been reported that the effect of such experiences on the children concerned is emotionally devastating, and that following demobilization, they're often troubled by nightmares, hallucinations, delusions, or they find it difficult to disengage from the idea that violence is a legitimate means of achieving their ends. The last quote there is again by Daniel, the boy who was forced to cut off his parents' hands and those of his siblings. And he says, "To kill when once you've started, you feel you're highly committed with drugs. It's not drugs, it's the killing. That's the kind of mind you develop." If such individuals find their way into the mental health system, like other psychiatric patients in Sierra Leone, they're likely to be kept in chains. Stephanie Goins and I conducted a repertory grid study comparing former child soldiers with young people who hadn't been combatants. And surprisingly, we found that while both groups viewed themselves in a more negative light during the war than before it, this tendency was significantly less in the former child soldiers. The child soldiers are the bottom line on the graph. And the former child soldiers, unlike the non-combatants, saw themselves following the war, and as they will be in the future, even more favourably than they were before it. And it seemed that these young men and women were able to disavow responsibility for their actions by seeing themselves as only following orders, and by contrasting themselves with their rebel commanders, who were construed very negatively. I think also it may be that community programs of forgiveness and reconciliation significantly enhanced their self-esteem. So let's come back to more conventional serial killers. And unlike Paul, who committed a single violent act in response to his father's provocation, and unlike child soldiers, whose multiple acts of violence are generally not freely chosen, a serial killer like Ian Brady can be considered to be what's been called an instrumental offender, someone whose offences essentially reflect their philosophy of life. As such, Brady is unlikely to be traumatised by these actions, since essentially they're not out of character. Ian Brady considers his own philosophical position to be one of moral relativism, involving questioning what the majority accept as true and valid simply by external majority consensus. The second quote is from one of his letters to me, and in it, he makes it clear that he regards the actions of petty criminals, perhaps including himself, as relatively trivial compared to those of the Bush gang of ex-oil executives and their recent successful armed robbery in Iraq. He's particularly vitriolic about Tony Blair, whom he describes as a psychopath who bombed 5 countries in 6 years, and so on. And Brady continued this theme when I asked him to define evil. He equates evil with ignorance, and he regards it as a characteristic of every US president since World War II, as well as Tony Blair, Margaret Thatcher, Stalin. And he feels that all of these people should have been tried for war crimes and hung. Brady has also written about guilt. And here again, his writing is very similar to George Kelly, the originator of personal construct theory. For Kelly, guilt was the experience of finding that one is behaving in a way which is different from one's core role, the way in which one has always seen oneself. And similarly, Brady considers guilt as involving being in conflict with one's own moral and ethical convictions, not merely those of others. For Brady, the serial killer has as many admirable facets of character as anyone else, and sometimes more so. And the serial killer has their own personal code of ethics and morals. And personal disloyalty for Brady is the worst crime of all, which was reflected in the way that he reacted to his partner in crime, Myra Hindley, when he felt that she was betraying him. An example of the personal morality of the killer is provided by this quote from Reggie Cray, the London gangster who'd committed murder himself and ordered very many other killings. And in this quote, Cray expresses his outrage at being asked by a fellow prisoner if he could obtain a knife to allow him to stab a black prisoner so that he could be certified insane and transferred to a psychiatric hospital. For Cray, despite being himself a murderer, it was against his principles to be involved in anything so fundamentally immoral. The acknowledgement that even murderers may have moral convictions and human qualities challenges fixed notions of good and evil. We live in times in which we are told in no uncertain terms not only what is evil, but where it is located. However, for Ian Brady, as for George Kelly, good and evil constitute a construct, which people use in their own individual ways. While for George W. Bush, Iran was part of his axis of evil, the USA in turn was construed by the Iranian regime as the great Satan. Regimes also shift their placement of other regimes or individuals on this construct over time, with those like Saddam Hussein, who've been viewed as friends to the West, eventually being reconstrued as villains. So I'd like to consider some further examples which question the distinction between good and evil. Starting with this piece of writing, I like to see people in happiness. I like to do good. I love democracy. I detest any criminal acts. I like kids. I like all animals. I love public and community service. I hate to see hunger, unemployment, oppression, war, aggression, ignorance, illiteracy. I was a trades union officer. I was a good soldier and non-commanding officer. I was a fair policeman. I was an effective civil servant. Stop, this all counts for nothing when I can kill 15 men without any reason and attempt to kill about 9 others in my home and under friendly circumstances. Am I mad? I don't feel mad. Maybe I am mad. That was written by Dennis Nilsson, the man who blocked the drains with the body parts of his victims, and who was a former policeman. Ian Brader's book finishes with an afterword by someone called Peter Sotos, the inclusion of which was one of the publisher's conditions for taking on the book. And Sotos's chapter is an indignant, righteous rant which condemns the book as being child pornography. I'd never heard of Sotos, so I googled him and discovered that he himself has recently been convicted of possession of child pornography. And I also found some of his other writings, which include this: females are dogs whose only worth is as pawns for my pleasure. Almost exclusively, this involves physical violence. Ian Brady, Ted Bundy, Sutcliffe, Curtin, all of those are serial killers. All of them did exactly what all men would like to do. It's just that too many men are scared. They would rather be coddled. So that rather changes one's view of Peter Sotos. And my third example is an individual called Dush. You might have come across him in the news recently. He was in the newspapers last weekend. He was the commander of the notorious S21 detention center in Cambodia, in which 17,000 people were tortured by the Khmer Rouge, mostly after being imprisoned on trumped-up charges. And in fact, only 12 people escaped with their lives. And after working as a school teacher for many years, Dush was finally captured, and he's currently on trial for crimes against humanity. And I think the case against him is being led by an Australian prosecutor. But the first quote there is by Francois Bizot, who's a French ethnologist who'd found himself falsely accused of being a CIA agent. But at the insistence of Dush, who realized the injustice of the accusation, he became the only Westerner ever to be freed by the Khmer Rouge. Bizot, in the course of his captivity, had many long discussions with Dush. And in this quote, he's unable to reconcile his memory of this justice-loving man with the principal torturer of this vile jail responsible for these atrocities. the last quote there is from a book about S21. And interestingly, the author considers that to find the source of the evil that was enacted at S21 on a daily basis, we need look no further than ourselves. And that's a point I'll return to a bit later. A final area in which Brady's writing is very similar to Kelly's is in their description of punishment, which they see as primarily for the benefit of the punisher, who essentially uses it to distance themselves from the evildoer and from their own potential evil doing. In Brady's view, in punishing others, people are in a sense making some retribution for the crimes that they themselves have contemplated. He's also in little doubt about the ineffectiveness of punishment, except as a means by which resentful, hopeless prisoners can school others on shorter sentences in the study of crime and revenge. After he was convicted, Brady inhabited a series of prisons, but he was eventually transferred to a special psychiatric hospital, Ashworth. Some 9 years ago, after he was attacked by staff of the hospital and had his arm broken, he went on hunger strike, and he's been force-fed through a nasal tube ever since. He's very critical of the regime of the hospital, which he refers to as Treshworth, or Ashwhips. And this is a quote from his last letter to me, what he calls his sole update to the real world, where he writes about the hospital's moral and professional bankruptcy. He's fought for many years for the right to have a public appeal against his detention in hospital and to be transferred back to prison. I think, in fact, there are no clear psychiatric grounds for his hospitalization, but in hospital, he's not allowed to starve himself to death, which is an option that would be open to him in prison. Ironically, therefore, a massive amount of money is being spent on keeping alive this serial killer who wishes to die. When I first met Brady in Ashworth, I spontaneously held out my hand to shake his, and then found myself struggling not to flinch as I remembered what that hand had done. And hence the title of this talk, and the question of whether we should, metaphorically as well as literally, shake hands with a serial killer and attempt to see the world through their eyes. This kind of work attracts a fair amount of criticism, and it's often regarded as taking as much of an anything-goes, morally relativist stance as Brady sees himself as doing. And for example, a review of one of my first ventures in this area described the credulous approach of personal construct theorists as relativistic psychology at its most scientistically anemic. And it described me as providing the mentally disordered and detained Ian Brady with a professional platform to espouse his especially noxious ravings. This is a more favourable review of my chapter, written by Ian Brady. But worryingly, perhaps Brady indicates that the previous reviewer was right in that Brady has perceived my writing and George Kelly's theory as providing some validation for his own views. And this indeed is one of the hazards of adopting a credulous approach in this area. At least one personal construct psychologist, Trevor Butt, considers that one shouldn't apologize for being a relativist, since no one has ever been burnt at the stake by relativists. And the last quote there, and the last one I'm going to show you today, is by Novinsky, who's talking about the Columbine High School killings, and who says that people may and sometimes do willingly embrace an identity and choose a pathway that, when viewed from the outside, is dark and destructive. We need to understand the process by which individuals opt for a dark vision if we hope to prevent such choices and their consequences. Attempts to understand individuals such as serial killers are by no means easy, not least because, as we've seen, they may blur distinctions between good and evil, and in so doing require us to acknowledge the darker sides of ourselves. Arguably, though, they're far more likely to lead to prevention of actions that we might construe as evil than as a stance purely based upon condemnation and retribution. Thank you.
I'd like to thank David Winter for an enthralling talk. I've given more than 100 lectures in this theatre, and I've never heard that depth of silence. I think everyone was really paying incredible attention, and thanks for a most stimulating talk.
Thank you.